Okay, test, 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 that's a good volume. So this is Bio 231. And we've got two more weeks left, so four lectures. Today we're going to move on to digestive system. We just have to finish up just a couple of things for respiratory. And this is May 9th, Monday, May 9th. All right, and this week is your last lab. And then next week you have the fifth practicum. And some of you get after the practicum lab quiz number 10. And those of you that have Monday will get the practicum lab quiz number 10 and then the extra makeup quiz that can be used to substitute a poor grade for either an online quiz or a lab quiz. Okay, so that's where we stand. So next time, I believe we're going to do urinary system, but that's what we're going to do in lab today, urinary system and reproductive system. All right, the last things that we wanted to cover for respiratory system had to do with control of respiration, all right, and in particular, how the higher centers of your brain, like your cerebrum, can help adjust the respiratory rate. All right, so when we're talking about adjustments to respiratory rate, there are chemicals that are very important that are in your body. So you have interoceptors for chemicals inside your body that will regulate your respiration. It's still there. Okay. And what's the most important chemical for adjusting or regulating your respiratory rate? You might think that oxygen would be it. Is that a good example? I heard CO2, and as a matter of fact, exactly. CO2 is the most important chemical in your body for regulating your respiratory rate because involved with CO2, because of a carbonic anhydrase reaction, which I don't think you have to really know in this class, it changes the pH or changes the acidity or the alkalinity of your body, which drastically changes the rate of chemical reactions. So CO2 is the parameter that your body monitors, right, to regulate ventilation. And as you breathe CO2 out of your body, okay, you become more basic. As you retain carbon dioxide, you become more acidic. So you breathe a lot of acidity out of your body just by breathing because you're giving away CO2 to the atmosphere. All right, what are some other things? Well, we talked about proprioceptors. If you use muscles even non-strenuously, just by the act of moving joints around, that will give you the feeling that you should breathe, okay, because of proprioceptors. And other kinds of receptors as well, like pain receptors. So for instance, if I had a blunt probe in my hand that we use for dissection, even though it's very, very dull, right? It's not going to hurt you at all. But if I were to poke you on your arm or something and you weren't aware that I was going to do that, guess what you would do? The first thing, you'd go like that, and I don't even want to guess what the second thing would be. But the first thing would be a gasp, right? And then you'd move away from that stimulus, right? And then your respiratory rate would increase after that gasp, right? So just touching. And pain, of course, would even enhance that effect, and temperature as well. So a decrease in temperature can cause a gasp reflex. Like if I took an ice cube and came up behind you and put that ice cube on your back, okay, what's the first thing you would do? You would go like that, which is a gasp reflex, all right? So that would happen unless you saw me coming and you knew you were going to do that gasp reflex. You could inhibit that reflex, but if it all happened without you knowing it, it would produce that gasp. All right, and what is the temperature of the ocean around here? Is it nice and warm? Is it very tropical, or is it? It's cold, right? It's not frigid cold, but I think it's kind of frigid cold, right? If you were all to jump in the ocean right now, how would it feel? Really, really cold, even though it's, you know, it's not near 30 degrees, it's up near 50 degrees, 50 or 60 degrees. That reminds me of something that happened maybe about 5 years ago. There is a company called Hornblower Yachts. I don't know if any of you heard of this company. And they have these big ships that can travel around in Marina Del Rey and also at Newport Harbor. And they can't really go out of the harbor because they're not seaworthy, but they can stay in the harbor and kind of tool around. And they like to host parties, like wedding parties and maybe Christmas parties and things like that. You can rent the whole boat and have maybe 50 or 60 people, right, and have a party. And it's really kind of fun, and you see all the harbor lights. That's really nice. Well, one Christmas Eve, somebody was having a business Christmas party, and everybody was all dressed up, of course, because it was a Christmas party, and it was up in Marina Del Rey, and one of these boats, the engine caught fire, and the engine stopped working, and then the boat caught on fire. So what does that mean? Well, people can't stay on the boat, right, when it's burning down like that, and they didn't have lifeboats because it wasn't supposed to be a seaworthy vessel at all. And so people had to jump off in the middle of the night in the harbor, pitch black out there, so they couldn't really see what they're doing. And there you are in your suit coat, right, and your fancy dress, and you have to jump in the ocean. Well, it was just the bay, not really the ocean, but the bay. So can you imagine what this was like? Would you like to do? Oh, it's probably really scary, but can you imagine hitting the water? And what would happen as soon as you hit the water? Well, you would go kaplunk. Your head would go underwater, and then you feel that cold, and what do you do when you feel that cold? And your head is underwater. You go, and you feel that cold water, and I was really amazed that nobody drowned, because that's exactly what would happen, and there were no lifeboats. But what I learned later was they didn't have lifeboats, but everybody was given a life preserver before they jumped overboard, which probably prevented them from going underwater when they jumped in. And that was probably why nobody drowned, due to that gasp reflex, okay? But just think of that as being just a really rude thing to do in the middle of a party, in the middle of the night, in the middle of a harbor like Long Beach Harbor or Marina Del Rey or Newport Harbor. And so anyway, that gasp reflex is very powerful, okay? And that's due to what? These other kinds of sensory receptors that you have on your body. All right, so that's it for respiratory system. Unless somebody has a question and I should review any material for a respiratory system. No? Okay, let's move on to digestive system. Well, here are the components of the digestive system. Let's move this over here. Okay, maybe I'll turn the lights down just a little bit. Like that. Like that. Like that. Is that too dark? Is that okay? Can you see your notes? All right, because these cameras are getting a little bit dull. All right, so here are all the components of the respiratory system, starting with your oral cavity. You should know something about your teeth. I don't really go into the teeth, but you have a number of different kinds of teeth. Some are made for grinding. Some are made for grabbing. Some are made for cutting, like incisors. The grinders would be the molars, for instance. All right, and you also have some salivary glands, right? You got three locations for salivary glands, like the parotid, the sublingual, right, and submandibular underneath the mandible right here. And they mostly secrete mucus and water so that when you chew a bolus of food, it can slide down the esophagus without getting trapped in the esophagus. All right, but it also secretes a little bit of an enzyme that can do a little pre-digestion of complex carbohydrates like starch. All right, so those are the salivary glands. The esophagus then carries food to the stomach. We'll look at the function of the stomach in just a little bit. Then you got a long segment right here, which is the small intestine. Small intestine's got three divisions, and you should know which one is the proximal, middle, and distal division. Like, which is the middle division? Anybody know what the middle division is? It is the jejunum. The proximal is the duodenum. Proximal means that it's connected to the stomach, and then the distal part is connected to the large intestine, and that is the ileum. So you got duodenum, jejunum, and ileum. And then you got the large bowel, large intestine right here, and its divisions. And that's pretty much the digestive system, with the exception of some accessory structures that aid in digestion, like the liver and gallbladder. Okay, and the salivary glands are also part of these accessory structures, and the pancreas that we have under here. All right, so we're going to look at these things. All right, now don't forget, layers are really important in anatomy because it's important clinically. All right, so let's see if we can find some layers of the digestive tract. And all parts of the digestive tract, excluding the mouth, have all of these layers right here. The outermost layer is the serosa. And that is kind of a thin layer of connective tissue, and it's slippery, right? It's continuous with the peritoneal membrane because these visceral organs are moving around. They're moving digesting material through your digestive tract, so they're squishing around inside your peritoneal cavity all the time. All right, the next deepest layer from the serosa, oh, I started at the number four over here, superficially, then we're working our way on the inside. The next layer is the muscularis layer. So here is muscularis externa. And in most parts of the digestive tract, there are two layers. There's a longitudinal and a circular layer. These are smooth muscles, so longitudinal means from end to end of the cell goes along with the direction of the digestive tract. The circular layer wraps around and almost kind of acts like a circular smooth muscle that can contract. So here's the muscularis layer. And within this layer, I see some of these yellow fibers right here. That is the myenteric nerve plexus, which helps control how these different smooth muscles contract, because it's got to be controlled in a very uniform way, right, and a very specific way for peristalsis that we're going to talk about in just a little bit. So this is the myenteric nerve plexus. And do you think your spinal cord has a lot of neurons in it? That's part of your central nervous system. Will you guess a few or a lot of neurons in your spinal cord? A lot or little? Who says a lot? Nobody. Who says a little? Nobody. Well, your spinal cord is what? Is a very large part of your nervous system, central nervous system. So there's a lot of neurons in the spinal cord. But, well, this might not be so impressive if you don't see that. There are more nerves in your, there are more neurons in your digestive system than there are in your spinal cord, because that's how important it is to control the passage of digesting material through your digestive tract. As a matter of fact, there's so many nerves that for people for years and years and years thought that your digestive system was really your brain that controlled the rest of your body, because there are so many nerves in these different plexes. Here's the plexus in the muscularis mucosa, and there's even some down in the submucosa as well. All right, so your digestive tract is loaded with neurons. All right, the next layer right here, submucosa. It's loose connective tissue, it has arteries and veins, it has lymphatic vessels that I see right here. So here is submucosa, right? And here are some glands in the submucosa, here are the blood vessels, there it has more nerves, right? And these could be both parasympathetic and sympathetic nerves. And remember, parasympathetic stimulation increases digestion and motility. Sympathetic nerves decrease. Right? Sympathetic, on the other hand, stimulates the heart, right? But it inhibits the digestive tract. So always think of the fight and flight versus the rest and digest mechanisms for understanding the actions of the autonomic nervous system. Okay, and then deep to that we have the mucosa right here. And it's got a couple different layers. The deepest layer is just an epithelium, and these are mostly just a simple epithelium, and it can be columnar, it can be cuboidal, or it could even be squamous, depending on what part of the digestive system it is. Okay. And then the rest of it, right here, sometimes we call this the lamina propria. It can have lymphatic organs to fight infection, and it can have glands for secreting material into the small intestine. So you got the serosa, the muscularis, right, the submucosa, and then the mucosa right here. And usually it's the mucosa which is the thinnest layer. So those are the layers of the digestive tract. Okay, let's talk about motility, movement of material through the digestive tract. There are two ways that things can move, either by peristalsis or by segmentation. And those nerve plexes are very important for controlling these different two kinds of motion. Peristalsis is the motion of a bolus of food from the mouth all the way down to the anus without moving backwards. So it's just antegrade flow of material, right? Just in one direction. So here would be a wave of this circular smooth muscle contracting, moving this bolus of food in one direction through the digestive tract. So that is peristalsis. Segmentation is a different kind of motion, and this is a mixing motion, right? So the digestive tract will contract at rings in a sequential way, but also in a segmental way. So all of these different rings will contract together. So for instance, if you have a bolus of food in this location right here, at another point in time, this is the smooth muscle, the circular smooth muscle that's going to contract. And so this bolus of food, some of it will be mixed with the compartment of above it, and part of it will mix with the compartment below it. Okay, and then it's going to contract in this area again, and so this just separates this material out, right, and mixes it all together without any of it moving, okay, in an antrograde fashion. So this is a mixing. So it's going to be mixing food with digestive enzymes, mixing food with maybe different kinds of buffers, which we'll talk about in just a little bit. So this is not really propulsion of food, this is mixing. All right, so if on the test you have propulsion of food, what kind of motion does that? That is, propulsion is peristalsis. This is moving along the digestive tract, but mixing is going to be due to something we call segmentation. Different kinds of muscles are used at a little bit different time. Okay, like, how does food move down through the esophagus? Would you say segmentation or peristalsis? Peristalsis, right? So a bolus of food is never really trapped in the esophagus. It's never really mixed with anything. It just transits the esophagus through the thoracic cavity down into the stomach. Now, when things get into the stomach, things change. Okay? We see the function of the stomach is primarily storing and mixing. And when I say mixing, what kind of motility is mixing? That is segmentation, right? And even I think you had a lab quiz where the stomach had three layers of smooth muscle, not just two. So it's very efficient at mixing. Some other functions of the digestive tract will be digestion and absorption. But from what we see here and the function of the stomach, right, is digestion and absorption an important function of the stomach? No, it's mostly just storing and mixing, okay, mixing food together. There's a little bit of initial digestion of proteins with an enzyme called pepsin, right? And pepsin needs to have hydrochloric acid secretion in order to become activated and in order for it to work. So the contents of the stomach are very acidic, maybe a pH of 2, right? And there is the secretion of mucus from the mucosa on the stomach, and that mucus is resistant to digestion of pepsin and it's resistant to hydrochloric acid. So mucus protects the lining of the stomach. The stomach also secretes something called intrinsic factor, which allows you to absorb vitamin B12. And vitamin B12 is necessary for red blood cell production. So if we don't have intrinsic factor, you'll become anemic as a result of that. And when the stomach is mixing food with gastric juice, then it becomes a substance we call chyme. All right, so let's take a look at the stomach. So food moves down through the esophagus into the stomach. So here's a good view of the stomach. And that's why the stomach has rugae, because as you eat, right, the stomach expands. It can hold a lot of food, and it can actually expand all the way down to the urinary bladder if you're eating a lot. So here is a good exam figure. We see that the entrance of the stomach right here at the esophagus, that's called the cardia, or sometimes the cardiac region. This region right here that traps a lot of gas, that's the fundic region. Then this is the body region. And then here is the pyloric region. This attachment of the esophagus to the stomach really doesn't have a well-defined sphincter. Sometimes in some people, it's fairly well-developed, right, which prevents acid reflux up into the esophagus. But if there ever is acid reflux up into the esophagus, that produces chest pain, referred pain, which can be sort of felt like somebody's having a heart attack, right, even though it's not really a heart attack, and that's why this is called the cardiac region, okay, right here. So these rugae allow for the stomach to expand. Now on the distal end of the stomach over here, this is a very powerful sphincter. and that's the pyloric sphincter. And this regulates the motion of chyme from the stomach into the small intestine. And the small intestine is primarily responsible for digestion and absorption. But it takes time for the small intestine to do its work, so that's why the stomach has to hold on to a lot of material until the small intestine is ready to receive more material for digestion and absorption. All right, so let's see. In the stomach, what are some parts of the stomach we want to look at? Okay, so if we look at the nice microscopic level of the stomach, so here's the serosa, here's the muscularis externa, right, here's the submucosa, and then here is the mucosa itself, and there are deep invaginations right here that are called glands. These are the gastric glands. If we look at the surface, it just kind of looks like a pit, so sometimes they're called gastric pits. And if we zoom into this region right here, okay, right in here, right, I can see some cells that will appear very whitish or clear depending on how a slide is prepared. These are the cells that secrete mucus. So what's the name of these cells right here? Those are goblet cells, right? And the stomach is just a nice simple columnar epithelium. There are also chief cells in this area right here that secrete pepsinogen, which is a precursor to pepsin, right? We don't want this part of the stomach digesting itself, so pepsin is secreted in an inactive form. When it gets into the stomach, then the hydrochloric acid converts it to pepsin, which then starts to digest some proteins. All right, and also the chief cells secrete pepsin, and the parietal cells secrete hydrochloric acid, okay? And that hydrochloric acid then goes to the stomach. What protects the lining of the stomach right here from that hydrochloric acid? It's that mucus secreted by these goblet cells that does that. So every day you secrete about 1.5 liters of gastric juice into the stomach. That's a lot. How much is that little bottle right there that you have? I don't know. Is that like a quarter of a liter? That's maybe a quarter of it, 250 mLs maybe? I don't know, I turned the lights off so you can't see, so I can make up anything. That's a quarter of a liter. So about 4 of those bottles, is that right? No, 6 of those bottles get dumped into your stomach every single day. Like that's 250 mLs up there that I see. All right, so that means that you lose a tremendous amount of fluid due to what your digestive processes every day. All right, now would it be a good idea to lose that fluid? No. All right, and we're going to find out what happens to that fluid in a little bit. All right, also in this lining right here are undifferentiated cells or stem cells, because as you learn, this area these cells are living in is a very rough environment. No cells die. All right, so about every 5 days, the lining of your stomach is replaced by those stem cells that can replace these cells right here. Okay. All right, so that is a very active area. All right, so don't forget, 1.5 liters of gastric juice is secreted into the stomach every day. All right, then after the stomach, where does food go? Into the, all right, after the stomach, then it goes into the small intestine when it traverses the pyloric sphincter right there. And the small intestine is the most important organ in your alimentary canal for digestion and absorption. Most of the material is absorbed through the small intestine, and most material is digested. All right, so when we say digestion, compounds are broken down into their building blocks. And we didn't talk much about the chemistry and building blocks, but you probably know some things. Like, what is the building block of a protein? It's amino acid, that's right. And then you have carbohydrates, complex carbohydrates, like starch. It has a basic building block as well, and that is called glucose. Glucose is a simple sugar, okay? And even triglycerides or fats have building blocks. And maybe if you use the analogy of amino acid to know that that's a building block of a protein, maybe somebody could guess what the building block of a triglyceride is. It's not an amino acid, it's a something we call a fatty acid, okay? So different foods have different building blocks, and that's where they're broken down in the small intestine, and then the basic building blocks are absorbed into the circulatory system. Okay, so let's see if I can find a picture of the small intestine someplace. All right, so here's a really good example of the small intestine. All right, so in order for all of that process to take place, this tube should be really long. Okay, and as a matter of fact, material is going to move from the lumen of the small intestine into these blood vessels right here and lymphatic vessels. So what do you need in order for materials to move from the lumen into these blood vessels? And the answer is, it's the same way that you got into this room. How did you enter this room? You walked in through what kind of structure? What kind of structure did you walk through? You walked through that doorway over there, right? And last time, what did I say? How should you think of a doorway in terms of anatomy? It's the surface area. It's just the width times the height, right, of that doorway is the surface area. As the surface area increases, what happens to exchange across that doorway? It goes up, right? As you make the doorway bigger, more people can walk through at the same time. So what about the doorway for nutrients entering your body from the small intestine? You think it should be small or large? Well, you want to absorb all those nutrients that are in your food, so it should be a large doorway. So let's consider how the small intestine makes that doorway really large. All right, and when we say doorway, what should we be thinking of? The surface area, right? So what's the total surface area of the small intestine? Well, it fits inside your abdominal cavity. One of the reasons why it fits in there, because look at all of these folds in the small intestine. And they kind of wrap around in transverse section, so we call these circular folds. So that's one way that the small intestine is able to fit, right? If we were to flatten out all these folds, your small intestine would probably be about 5 times longer than it is right now. So that increases the surface area, right? These circular folds, sometimes they're called the plicae circularis, or that in Latin just means circular folds, right here. All right, but if we look at a circular fold, which you can see with your naked eye, right, if we were to look at small intestine, and maybe with your fetal pigs, you should open up some small intestine and take a look, it doesn't have a flat surface. It looks kind of velvety. And you can actually see these things with your naked eye, or just barely see them with your naked eye. It has these finger-like projections sticking off of the circular folds, and we call these villi. So again, we could take these villi and flatten them out, and that would increase the length of that tube maybe another 5 or 10 times, making it a lot longer, increasing the surface area. So these are two things that make the surface area for exchange a lot bigger: the circular folds and the villi right here. All right, so here is a villus, and this villi are made up of these cells. Again, here's the mucosa that I can see on a villus. And these cells right here, what kind of cell does this look like? Goblet cell secreting mucus to protect the mucosal lining of the small intestine. Right here is an intestinal crypt that can secrete enzymes into the small intestine. But let's look at these cells that line a villus, and here they are. So here is a columnar cell. And look at the surface, the apical surface of this cell right here. Is it flat, or what kind of specialization does it have? It has microvilli on it. And so what's the job of these microvilli? It increases the surface area of the apical surface of this cell, right? I could grab the cell right here with my left hand and grab it over here, pinch it with my right hand, and do what? I could stretch it out to make all of those microvilli absolutely flat. And when I were to do that with all of these millions of cells, that also then makes the length of the small intestine really, really long. That adds to the doorway. Okay, so those are the three structures that add to the surface area of the small intestine for absorption. It increases the doorway. The first thing is the plicae circularis, the second thing is a villus, and then the third thing is the microvilli, right? And definitely you need a good microscope to see those microvilli, but you can almost see these individual villi. All right, so what would happen? Well, if the surface area of the small intestine, if it were just a simple straight tube without any folds, if it was completely flat without any of these specializations right here, the plicae, the villi, or microvilli, right, the surface area would be about 3.5 square feet. What did we say the doorway was right here? Oh, we know, we measured it in meters, okay, not feet. But we could do a calculation. It was 2 square meters, all right, so that would be, it would be like 6 times 3, oh, what's 6 times 3? Okay, about 18 square feet, all right? So the small intestine would even be the size of that doorway right there, would be maybe about a third of it, okay? But if we take into account all of these folds right here, the surface area increases from 3.5 square feet to 2,200 square feet, all right? So what is that? That's huge. That's 240 square meters. So that's the doorway for exchange, namely what? Absorbing nutrients from the small intestine, right? That's why the small intestine is the most important organ for absorption of nutrients from your diet, from the food that you eat, all right? But what's 240 square meters like in real life? Well, that's the floor area of an average two-level house. So if you live in a single-level house, okay, your doorway of your small intestine is twice that. So that's a huge surface area for exchange. All right, but what kind of blood vessel is necessary to absorb? What can absorb nutrients? What kind of blood vessel? What are the three main kinds? You've got arteries, you got veins, and capillaries. So what kind of blood vessel is going to be absorbing these nutrients? Yeah, capillaries, right? And in the villus, you can see a network of capillaries right here that will be absorbing sugars and proteins, or the building blocks, right, some simple sugars like glucose and amino acids right here. But lipids are not absorbed by the circulatory system because they probably would have a tendency to plug up a blood vessel or to plug up a blood vessel. What absorbs lipids from our small intestine is this central vessel that is right on the inside of this capillary plexus, and that is part of the lymphatic system. Right, this part of the lymphatic system that goes up into a villus is a lymphatic capillary, but it's specialized for absorbing lipids, so we call it a lacteal. A lacteal is just a lymphatic capillary specialized for absorbing lipids in our diet after they're partially digested in the small intestine. All right, some of the glands that you have in the small intestine, you have Brunner's glands in the duodenum. Right, and it secretes an alkaline material. So Brunner's glands, right, would look something like this right here, Brunner's gland, and it secretes an alkaline fluid, namely like bicarbonate, into the lumen of the small intestine. And what's the job of that bicarbonate or that alkaline solution? What's it doing? What happens if you have an acid and you put a base together? What happens? They neutralize each other, right? So that material neutralizes the stomach acid, because the small intestine can't protect itself from hydrochloric acid, so that material neutralizes the hydrochloric acid so that the small intestine doesn't get dissolved away. That's really important. Okay, there are also crypts, which sometimes are called intestinal glands. Like here is an intestinal crypt right here. Sometimes we call that a crypt of Lieberkühn. And it secretes mucus, and it also secretes some hormones like secretin and cholecystokinin, right? And these hormones tell the gallbladder to contract, and these hormones also tell the stomach what to do, right? Because remember, the stomach is holding on material until the small intestine is ready, and secretin inhibits the stomach from contracting. So when the small intestine is busy, It's secretin, which then tells the stomach to become quiet. And then when the small intestine is done doing its job, the hormone secretin goes down, and then the stomach becomes more active and it pushes more chyme into the small intestine so that it can be digested and absorbed. Okay, and of course there are undifferentiated epithelial cells in the small intestine because of all the digestive enzymes, the lining of the small intestine is replaced basically once a week, every 3 to 5 days, like the lining of the stomach. All right, and then there are some cells, right here, some malt, some mucosa-associated lymphatic tissue, sometimes they're called Paneth cells, that help control infection because there are bacteria in the small intestine, and it prevents those bacteria from entering your body. Okay, some of these beneficial bacteria help in producing vitamins in our body. So you have to have them in your small intestine, but you don't want them going through the mucosa or submucosa and getting into your body. So that's pretty much the small intestine, but somewhere in here, it should tell me how much fluid is secreted into the small intestine every day. Ah, right here. All right, almost 2 liters. Let's say 2 liters, just to make it easy. So how much fluid has been secreted already into the digestive tract? How much saliva is produced every day? It's lost from your circulation. Oh, did I forget to mention that? Okay. Saliva, oh, you know what? It's about 0.5 liter. So you produce about 0.5 liter of saliva every day, which dehydrates your body. You produce 1.5 liters of gastric juice every day, which dehydrates your body. So that's 2 liters. And then 2 liters of fluid from the small intestine. So that's 4 liters of fluid that you're being dehydrated every single day. That's added to your digestive tract. Okay, so that's going to take us to the large intestine. I'm going to go back and talk about the pancreas in just a little bit, but let's move on to the large intestine. All right, so here are the parts of the large intestine, which you kind of looked at already in lab. All right, so I want to move on to digestion just a little bit, but I think I want to put this picture up just for fun. So here is the large intestine. All right, here's a small intestine in this area right here. It's removed from this picture, but what's the function of the small intestine in this area right here? Digestion, right? Breaking down complex compounds into simple compounds for what process? Absorption, right? So food nutrients are absorbed by the small intestine, and as a matter of fact, none should be entering the large intestine right here. Absolutely no nutrients whatsoever. It should be completely taken care of by the small intestine. All right, but so why do you have a large intestine? Because the small intestine can't resorb all of that water that you've lost, which is what? Almost 4 liters now. So the job of the large intestine is to resorb that 4 liters of water that you've secreted into your alimentary canal so far and return it to your cardiovascular system so you don't dehydrate, as well as some salts, right? And salts are important electrolytes that help regulate the electrical part of your body, like nerves and muscle contraction and things like that. Okay, so the large intestine right here, no digestion should be taking place, and absorption of no nutrients, only water and some salts. Another function of the large intestine is that it is loaded with bacteria, and these are not harmful bacteria under most circumstances, as long as your immune system is working properly, and those bacteria produce precursors to various vitamins that you need, like vitamin K. Okay, vitamin K action on plant materials, and vitamin K is necessary to have proper blood clotting function so that if you cut yourself or bump yourself, if you bruise, then you don't bleed excessively so that you can actually form a clot. Okay, so another way of saying absorption of water from chyme is fecal production. So the large intestine produces feces by what? Resorbing water from your digestive tract that you've lost, basically 4 liters. right here. Okay, now there are sometimes the large intestine can't do its job. Maybe it becomes irritated for one reason or another. Okay, like maybe you have an infection. It produces what when you have an infection of the large intestine or an irritation of the large intestine? What does it produce? It produces copious amounts of watery stool. What do we call that? You all know what that's called. That's called diarrhea. One of the easiest ways to get diarrhea is with food poisoning or water poisoning. Water poisoning is not very common in the United States because where can we get clean water from? Basically any faucet that we have, right, in many, many rooms of our house, right? But in other parts of the world, they are not so fortunate to have clean drinking water. And when you drink contaminated water, for instance, if you were to walk up into the local mountains here and just drink water out of a stream, what would be a likely scenario? Diarrhea. Yeah, because there's a little microorganism called Giardia up there that can give you really significant diarrhea. It could be even life-threatening. As a matter of fact, probably more people die of diarrhea in this world compared to any other kind of disease process. And what does that do to? Drinking contaminated water. Okay? And guess who is most susceptible to that? Children are most susceptible to that. So if you're really interested in saving lives on this planet and you want to save more lives than anybody else, guess what the only thing you have to do is? Figure out how to get clean drinking water to everybody. It just seems like such a simple solution, but it's really difficult in certain parts of the world. Okay? So diarrhea certainly is deadly because what happens? You dehydrate and you lose electrolytes. So your heart maybe will stop contracting because it doesn't have the proper electrical electrolytes, right? And nerve conduction is important as well. So there's another way that somebody can get diarrhea, and that is, for instance, we said that the large intestine is loaded with bacteria, right? And those bacteria need nutrients. But what did we say about nutrients entering the large intestine from the small intestine? Does that usually happen? It does not usually happen, right? If they're all really absorbed. But every once in a while, it does happen. For instance, some people become lactose intolerant. Lactose is a sugar, and I think it's made out of one galactose sugar and one glucose molecule put together. As we get older, we lose the ability to produce an enzyme to break that more complicated sugar down. It's called lactase, is the enzyme. We all lose that ability. And whenever we eat a dairy product, then lactose isn't broken down in the digestive tract, and since it's not broken down, it doesn't get absorbed. And where does it go? Lactose goes right into the large intestine right here through this ileocecal valve. And guess who's waiting in the large intestine? Billions of bacteria, all right? And they see that lactose coming, and they all have big smiles on their faces, and they go nuts because now they have a sugar. It's like a milkshake for them. So what happens? They start to reproduce, proliferate like crazy, and they produce a lot of gas that produces an irritation, which increases motility of material through the large intestine. It decreases absorption of water, which then produces what? Copious amounts of watery stool. Right, which is diarrhea. That scenario is what we call malabsorption syndrome. So whenever we eat a material that we can't digest and absorb in the small intestine, it produces what? Malabsorption syndrome, which, right, produces that diarrhea. And of course, that could be life-threatening if it isn't placed under control relatively quickly. Okay, so as a matter of fact, there was a drug that people would take to block the absorption of lipids in their diet. And it was called Xenical. I think it was called Xenical. It might come back to me if it wasn't. Xenical, so it blocked absorption of lipids from your diet because when people are overweight, one way to help reduce their weight or control their weight is to block absorption of lipids or reduce it in your diet because lipids contain a lot of energy, twice as much compared to sugars or proteins per weight. So somebody had a really good idea, well, let's just block the absorption and that will help somebody lose weight. And indeed, that did help people lose weight, but all those lipids entered the large intestine right here, and what did that produce? Malabsorption syndrome, right? Because all those bacteria said, ah, lipids, thank you very much. They just rage the big party, and what does that produce? Diarrhea, but a special kind of diarrhea, not just copious amounts of watery stool, but copious amounts of watery, oily stool, right? Because the lipids weren't being completely absorbed by those bacteria and the person as well. All right. And as a matter of fact, there was so much diarrhea, a person could never tell if they were stooling themselves or not. So what do you have to wear when you lose control of evacuation? You'd have to wear a diaper. All right, so that pharmaceutical agent then quickly lost favor with society because nobody wanted to lose weight, right, trading off that they would have to wear a diaper and not know when they were stooling themselves. All right, so that was just, what do we call that? That's a side effect. The other thing that was really bad is that some vitamins are absorbed with lipids that you eat, fat-soluble vitamins, so that when you are losing fats in your diet, you're not absorbing vitamins either, right? So you have a vitamin deficiency. Well, they thought and thought, pharmaceutical companies thought and thought, well, you know, this is a pretty good drug. Maybe we'll reduce the dose so that it will block some of the absorption of lipids and not produce such a bad malabsorption syndrome. And I think last year or year before, it was reintroduced with a new name. And it probably still produces malabsorption syndrome, but maybe not to the point to where somebody has to wear a diaper when they're driving. And what is that called? Does anybody know what that's called? That was called Ally. Oh, the sign-in sheet. Thank you so much. Yeah, I want to make sure, because I had one specially made out for you guys. So here's a sign-in sheet. All right, so a lot of times you might be taking some medication, and one of the side effects of the medication is diarrhea, when you read the label on that drug. And so how is that working? Why does it produce diarrhea? Well, usually that drug is preventing absorption of some kind of nutrient in a part of your digestive tract, namely what part? What part is important for absorption of nutrients? The small intestine. So you might be taking a drug and it's blocking the absorption of one kind of amino acid or another, or sugar, or preventing absorption of something that enters the large intestine, which produces that malabsorption syndrome. Okay, so that just kind of underscores the importance of the large intestine, but make sure you know all the different pieces, like this first piece right here. That's the cecum, and in some animals, like you've seen fetal pig, the cecum is very large, right, because they eat a lot of more plant material than people do. People don't eat so much plant material, so the cecum has shrunk down, and here's a little vestigial remnant of a regular-sized cecum, and it's called the vermiform appendix. And what's left in here are not glands for absorption or mucus glands, but lymphatic tissue, that mucosa-associated lymphatic tissue to fight infection, to make sure those bacteria don't enter your body from the large intestine. Okay, and then we've got the ascending colon, transverse, descending, sigmoid colon, rectum, and anal canal. Make sure you know these flexures right here, like the hepatic flexure and splenic flexure on the left. These ligaments, the tenia coli, which are anchor points for circular smooth muscle. And these little pockets right here that are called haustra. And so these are just modifications for what? Absorption of water from the large intestine. Okay, what are some other things to know about the digestive tract? Oh, pancreas. Let's go back to the pancreas. All right, that's an accessory structure. And you should be aware of where the pancreas is. Okay, I don't think I have a real special picture of the pancreas. Oh, yeah, here's a really good picture. Oh, you had to draw this. All right, you had to draw out the bile duct system, which included the pancreas. So here's the pancreas. And look, it's made out of lots of little, almost microscopic lobes. It kind of looks on gross inspection like there's worms in there, right? So it looks a lot different than the spleen. What did the spleen look like? It was long and narrow like the pancreas, but it was really different because the spleen was what? The spleen had a really flat, shiny surface. It didn't have all these little lobulations in it, okay, like the pancreas does. And so here, these areas right here are filled with glands, two different kinds of glands. There are exocrine glands and endocrine glands in the pancreas. So what kind of gland is an endocrine gland? What does it do? You were tested on it already. You studied a whole chapter on endocrine glands. What does an endocrine gland secrete? A hormone. Yeah, and what makes a hormone a hormone? Where does it get secreted to? Directly into the circulatory system, right into the blood. It doesn't need a duct to find its way to the place where it's going to perform its action. All right, so there are places in the pancreas that produce insulin and another hormone called glucagon for regulating glucose metabolism or blood glucose levels. Let's see what I said right here. Ah, good. Okay, now, is blood glucose an important parameter in your body? Can it change drastically? Should it change drastically? Should it go sky high and then go down to zero? No, neither case is good. It's got to be regulated just like your heart rate or just like your heart. So, how is your heart regulated? What kind of mechanism is used for regulating your heart? Well, this is the autonomic nervous system. How many divisions are there to the autonomic nervous system? There's two. What are they called? Sympathetic and parasympathetic. And what is the relationship between sympathetic and parasympathetic? They're antagonistic, right? Just like the gas pedal and brake in your car. Right? So it's not a futile system. It's a perfect system for maintaining precise control and balance. And the system for maintaining precise control and balance over your blood sugar are these two hormones, insulin and glucagon. So guess what the relationship is between insulin and glucagon? Just take a wild guess. I haven't told you. It's got to be what? Antagonistic to each other, right? For that precise control and balance. And indeed, insulin decreases blood sugar, right? And some people, when they have a meal, they have to get an injection of insulin because their body isn't producing it. So after a meal, your blood sugar would go sky high. You get the injection of insulin, what happens to blood sugar? Goes back down to a normal level. Okay. Glucagon, on the other hand, increases blood sugar. Now, why do you want to increase blood sugar? Because you're not always in a fed state. You're always not eating something. What's another state that you could be in? If you're not in a fed state, you could be in a fasted state. Like, when would be a good example of when you're in a fasted state? As soon as you wake up in the morning. Right, unless you're a sleepwalker and you went to the refrigerator and drank a couple beers or margaritas or a cake or whatever you have in the refrigerator, you're going to be in a fasted state. Your blood sugar is going to decrease, but it's the job of the pancreas to secrete glucagon, which then takes starch from your liver, converts it into glucose, and that glucose goes in the blood to maintain your blood glucose levels even though you're sleeping and you're in a fasted state. So insulin and glucagon are antagonistic to each other, maintaining glucose just in that proper level. All right, so that's the endocrine function. The exocrine function of the pancreas is that it makes various kinds of digestive enzymes, trypsin and chymotrypsin for protein digestion, and amylase for, I didn't tell you, what amylase is also made by the salivary glands. Salivary amylase will break down starch. Anybody know what the basic building block of starch is? It breaks starch down into its building block, which is glucose. So starch is basically a sugar, right? So we were just talking about diabetes mellitus, sort of in a roundabout way. Right? It had to do with sugar metabolism, insulin, and sugar regulation in the blood. So starch is something that a diabetic has to be very concerned with, because what is starch? Is basically a sugar. Even though it doesn't taste sweet, right? Its basic building block is glucose, which is a sugar. Right? So pancreatic amylase for starch digestion. And then you have pancreatic lipase for what kind of digestion? I'm not going to tell you, because there it is right there. It's in the word of the enzyme. Right? It's for lipids, and lipids are fats. Right? So this is a nice modern nomenclature. So today we take a substrate like lipid and put an ASE on the end of that word, and then we know it is an enzyme. Right? Just like there is a sugar called lactose, OSE is on the end of that word. What would be the name of the enzyme that breaks down lactose into its basic sugars? It would be you want to put ASE on the end of it? That would be what? Lactase. And that's what our bodies stop producing as we get older, as we mature, not as we get old, but as we mature. Okay, so those are the two functions of the pancreas, And then the exocrine means that it has to have a duct, so those digestive enzymes make their way to the small intestine via the major and minor or accessory pancreatic duct to the small intestine, right here. And the pancreas also makes material that helps neutralize stomach acid as well. Okay, so that's the function of the pancreas. Now we got the liver. Okay, the liver is important for detoxification of absorbed nutrients or absorbed toxins from our diet, but it also helps and aids in digestion, because you all know something about lipids and water, and that is what? Oily substances or lipids do what with water? Nothing. They ignore each other. As a matter of fact, they do more than ignore each other. They hate each other, right? They're never going to mix together. So in order for you to digest oils or fats in your diet, somehow you got to figure out a way for them to mix together. And how do you do that at home? Like, for instance, you get a grease spot on your clothes. How do you get it out of your clothes? Can you just wash it in water? No. You got to put detergent, right? Detergent will break down oils and allow them to dissolve in water, because a detergent is kind of a fancy molecule. One part of it looks like water, likes to be with water, and the other part likes to be with fat. It has both properties, so it can allow oil to dissolve in water because it will emulsify fats. All right? And so your body produces an agent that can emulsify fats, and that's called bile. And it's the job of the liver to produce bile. Right? And it's producing bile all the time and secreting it, and it's an exocrine function of the liver, because bile is not a hormone. So how does bile get delivered to where it's going to perform its action? Since it's an exocrine part of the liver. What does an exocrine gland have to have? A duct, yeah. So bile goes through some duct. So here we see the right and left hepatic duct, right? Anytime you hear that word hepato or hepa, you should think of liver. All right, so bile goes through the right and left hepatic ducts into the common hepatic duct. Right, and if you're in a fed state, then it goes right down, joins the pancreatic duct, and then enters the small intestine. Okay, what's the other state you could be in besides a fed state? A fasted state, when there is no food in the small intestine, then that bile has no reason going to the small intestine because there's no oils there to be emulsified. So it takes this little side route through the cystic duct into the gallbladder, which is just inferior to the liver. And then when you're in a fed state, then the gallbladder contracts because the small intestine releases cholecystokinin, which causes the gallbladder to contract, and then that squirts bile down into the small intestine for emulsifying fat so they can be digested with an enzyme. What kind of enzyme will digest a lipid? What kind of enzyme can digest a lipid? It's called pancreatic lipase, right? Okay, synthesized and secreted by the pancreas right here. All right, so everybody should really know, because this is an important exam figure, should know the right and left hepatic duct coming to join and form the common hepatic duct, and then after the cystic duct, that common hepatic duct becomes the common bile duct. In your book, it just bile duct, but a really good name is probably common bile duct, okay, to the small intestine, right there. All right, some other functions of the liver, right? It's a storage place of glycogen, right? And glycogen is the same thing as it's really an animal starch, all right? Plants make a compound called starch. The basic building block is glucose. Animals don't make starch, because plants do. They make something that's similar, that has a more branching pattern, so the structure is just a little bit different, but the basic building block is exactly the same as starch. What did we say the basic building block of starch was? Glucose, right? So glycogen is the complicated storage form of glucose in your body. So when your blood glucose level starts to go down, that's why glucagon can go to the liver and tell the liver to break down glycogen into glucose, and that goes into the blood, and that raises blood glucose levels. All right, so that's an important function of the liver when you're in the fasted state. Okay, but it can always also store certain vitamins like A, D, E, and K, because these are fat-soluble vitamins, easily stored in the liver. And vitamin B12, not necessarily a fat-soluble vitamin, but it can be stored in the liver. And since these can be stored in the liver right here and are fat-soluble, these are the vitamins that can become toxic. You can actually overdose on these vitamins as opposed to water-soluble vitamins. A good example of a water-soluble vitamin is vitamin C that can't be stored in lipid or the liver. So when you consume vitamin C in your diet every day and you don't use it, where does it go? It's eliminated in urine every day. So you can actually become deficient in vitamin C fairly rapidly. And the other thing is that it's almost impossible to have a vitamin C toxicity because you lose so much of it from your diet every day. So that's the importance of being water-soluble or fat-soluble. All right, the liver can also store iron and copper. Copper is necessary for some chemical reactions. And iron, what's iron necessary for? It's for making red blood cells. The compound in red blood cells is hemoglobin, and that iron acts as a pigment that makes the blood red, at least oxygenated blood bright red because of that. Okay. Some people can actually have an overdose of iron. They can have iron toxicity. Who do you think would be more susceptible to iron toxicity? What segment of our population? Children? Yeah, pretty good, but I was thinking something else. Elderly, yeah, that's pretty good, but I'm thinking something else. How about between males and females? Can become toxic, can have iron overload, males or females? Males, much more susceptible to iron overload, and why is that? Because females, right, will lose a lot of iron every month, so they're not nearly so susceptible to iron overload compared to males. All right, and the liver is also important for chemical conversions. It can make an active form of vitamin D. Right, it can convert a precursor form of vitamin D into an active form of vitamin D. And what the heck is vitamin D good for? You need vitamin D for absorption of calcium in your diet. And what good is calcium? What would be your favorite use for calcium in your body? Bones? Okay, that probably wouldn't be mine. But that's probably not a bad idea. What else? How about contraction of your heart? Right? You need calcium for muscle contraction. You need calcium for contraction of that diaphragm, for breathing. Right? And then also you need it for synaptic transmission, the way that neurons will communicate with each other. Right? From a presynaptic to a postsynaptic neuron, we need calcium to allow for release of neurotransmitter. Right? So to me, bones is like my third or fourth important reason to have good calcium in your body. All right? But of course, it is important because what can a lot of people suffer from if they don't have enough calcium in their diet and calcium is taken out of their bones to maintain their heart and their nervous system? That's called osteoporosis, right? Okay, so that is important. So how do you prevent osteoporosis from happening? Having exercise is real important, and having proper levels of vitamin D in your diet. Okay, and exercise is important. Just like when you exercise a muscle, it gets bigger and stronger. When you exercise those muscles, it pulls on a bone, that stresses a bone, that makes those bones bigger and stronger too. As long as you do that, especially for women premenopausally, then that helps protect you from osteoporosis. All right, liver can also convert fat into phospholipids. And What good is a phospholipid? What can you make with a phospholipid? Anybody remember? We did learn that chemical compound. Membranes. Every membrane, right, is a phospholipid bilayer. So you need millions of molecules of phospholipids just to make a membrane around a single cell. All right? And fortunately, liver can make phospholipids to make cell membranes. And as a matter of fact, any kind of membrane system inside of a cell, like a Golgi apparatus, or smooth or rough endoplasmic reticulum. It can convert some amino acids to sugar, right? Or it can convert some proteins to sugar and also to fat. So the liver can interconvert various kinds of food substances into each other. and it can convert ammonia, which is a product of protein metabolism inside your body, and ammonia is very toxic to nervous systems. You wouldn't be able to function at all if the concentration were to go up just a little bit in your body, so the kidney can convert it into urea, and then urea is easily excreted by the kidneys, thereby getting what? Ammonia out of your body. But the kidney cannot excrete ammonia because it goes everywhere too easily. But the kidneys can get rid of urea, so the liver is doing a fantastic job preventing you from becoming toxic. And the liver also makes a bunch of clotting factors so that when you cut yourself, you don't bleed to death. So it makes a lot of clotting, different kinds of clotting factors, which we don't get into in this class. But physiology, because I know you're interested in that. Physiology class, we'll talk about that. So those are the functions of the liver, okay, and the important parts of the digestive tract or alimentary canal and what their function is. So if I were to say absorption and digestion, small intestine. If I were to say storing and mixing, you would say stomach. And if I were to say absorption of water, large intestine. Right, so it resorbs almost those 4 liters that were dumped into your intestine. Before you go, I got one last little analogy to talk about. So when I think of the digestive system, all right, I see it secreting a lot of water, 4 liters of water into food that you ate, and then it's kind of resorbed and you absorb all those nutrients. I think of an appliance that you have at home. Okay, what appliance you have at home that I'm thinking of acts just like your digestive system? Just a little bit of a distinction. Okay? You throw a bunch of stuff in there, and then you throw a bunch of water in there, and then you throw maybe a little detergent in there, and then you suck it all out. And all the dirt goes with it. Okay? But in us, the dirt is really nutrients. But dirt, what do you do with the dirt when you're at home? You just throw it out, and what are you left with? You're left with clean clothes. Yeah, so I think of the digestive system as like being a washing machine, right? Adds all that stuff in there, mixes it all up, blah, blah, all the processes, and then absorbs nutrients, and then it throws kind of the rest of the stuff away. So think of it like a washing machine, mixing, right, and emulsifying, and then absorbing, all right? So think of it that way. Okay, so that's it, and I think the sign-in sheet is going around. Let me turn the lights on before you guys leave so you don't fall down the stairs. Okay, so who's got the sign-in sheet? Wave it really close, yeah, and they'll bring it down and make sure you sign the sign-in sheet before you take off. All right, so next time we got to do urinary system. Yeah, that's all. We're almost done, but we're like 30 seconds.